All of life works on responsibility. Everybody listening to this program has achieved what they've achieved in life because they took responsibility to make it happen. Government's no different than that.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Philip K. Howard. He's the author most recently of The Rule of Nobody, Saving America from Dead Laws and Broken Government. Philip K. Howard, thanks for talking to Reason.
Nice to be with you.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. When did The Death of Common Sense come out?
1995.
Okay. So, basically 20 years ago, you helped launch a conversation about the rule of kind of top-down or automatic regulation in American life, of politics on autopilot. And we're still in the thick of this. But it seems like your message might finally be getting through, that we need to really change things. In The Rule of Nobody, one of the things that you talk about again and again in compelling fashion are just these examples where we don't even know who to turn to. The government doesn't even know who to turn to when they need to get things done. Talk a little bit about the Kill Van Kull, which is one of the opening anecdotes of your
right.
book.
So in 2008, the Port Authority realized that the new generation of ships, post-Panamax ships, were not going to fit into Newark Harbor because the main bridge they have to pass under, the Bayonne Bridge, was 65 feet too low. The bridge had been built 80 years ago. It's like the fourth largest single span bridge in the, in the world. So they commissioned studies, and the studies came back to, well, either build a new bridge or a new tunnel. It's going to cost $4 or $5 billion to do this, wreak environmental havoc on the communities and such, and it won't be finished in time for the new ships in any event. The environmental review wouldn't be done for a decade. And the person in charge of the project, a lifelong Port Authority employee, said, well, is it possible that we could just raise the roadway within the existing 80-year-old bridge? And they sort of raised their eyebrows. Well, probably not, but we'll go look at it. A couple of months later, they came back, yes, we can. Not only can we raise the roadway within this existing single arch of the bridge, but we can use the existing foundations, they're structurally sound, and not change the right-of-way. We just have to raise it a little bit. So it's like a miracle. Instead of $4 or $5 billion, it was going to cost $1 billion.
And you don't even have to rejigger everything.
Nothing gets rejiggered. Right. It was just brilliant. And it should be ready in time for the post-Panamax ships. That was 2009. In the middle of 2013, over four years later, they were still arguing over how much environmental review was required. Groups had decided that they should study the effects of a more efficient port on the citizens of Newark, which is 7 miles away. Had nothing to do with the environmental effects of the bridge itself, which is sort of what the law is intended to protect against. Finally, it got approved over these objections, and of course, what's happened? They've started a lawsuit. So now the lawsuit is pending.
Right. And I mean, part of it is, I mean, the way you talk about it is that the people in charge of these operations don't even know who to turn to expedite things or who's in charge. Can you talk a little bit about that, where there's this vast diffuse, I mean, there are, is a blanket of rules that cover every move, and then there's kind of a fog where you don't even know who is enforcing this rule or that rule.
Right. So it's environmental review in this country is a process. No one's in charge. And so the Port Authority said, okay, well, under the rules, we need a, quote, lead agency to oversee our environmental review of this project. Well, who's going to be the lead agency? Nobody in the federal government has the authority to do that.
Right.
So they send letters out to all these different agencies, and they drop out. And finally, a year later, the Coast Guard is the last one standing, and they agree to be the lead agency. Then they have public meetings on, well, how much should we study? Again, no one's in charge of actually saying, well, how much should you study? So they have public meetings or arguments back and forth. That goes on for another year. Then they make a list of all the legal requirements that of things that must be studied no matter what. And one of them is you have to do a survey of historic buildings within 2 miles of the bridge. Well, the bridge isn't going to touch any historic buildings. It's the same right of way.
But you still have to do that.
But you still have to do it. The law says you have to do it. So then they have to go through a procurement process, because it's the government, which is its own neutral process, to find a consultant to do the survey of historic buildings, which is completely unnecessary. That takes a year. And many more. Yeah.
So in a different context in the book, you talk about how the president and the executive branch, as the head of the executive branch, doesn't really have very much authority over all of the agencies or personnel that he oversees. Talk a little bit about that.
So at one point, the Regional Office of Environmental Protection Agency was making noises that maybe you need a full environmental review to study the effects on the citizens of Newark. Meanwhile, the president of the United States, President Obama, issues a statement declaring this bridge is one of the top priorities in the country to get done for the economy and for jobs right away. He issues this statement that this is going to be a top priority, and 2 weeks later, the Regional Office of EPA sends a letter to the Port Authority saying, we're still not satisfied, and we think you should do a full-blown environmental review. It'll take another 5 years. Who are they working for? Who supposedly work for the president? Who's in charge of this show? I mean, no one's in charge, and so it's literally a ship without a captain.
And it's environmental rules are among the most kind of arcane and Byzantine. But it's not just about it's not just green whack jobs. It's all aspects of kind of government authority.
Yes, and so one of the things that I write about in the book is how the president of the United States actually doesn't have the authority to run the executive branch. He can't, except for a very small number of appointees, he can't hire and fire who he wants. He can't really even tell people what to do, because it's all kind of dictated by this accretion of law, which is built up, to keep the analogy, like sediment in the harbor.
Right.
And so this is a problem that's much worse now even than it was 20 years ago.
And it'll be worse, even worse 20 years in the future.
Oh, 20 years in the future. Yeah. I mean, we're already nearly paralyzed.
Right.
We won't be able to do anything.
By the way, is this broadly observed throughout kind of advanced economies? Is this just kind of like this stage of liberal democracy?
It's a problem in most Western democracies, but it's worse in our country than the other. Other countries have figured out ways to begin to deal with it by sunset laws of old law, things like that.
Another great example of kind of just insane regulation of minute things. Talk about Kansas retirement homes.
So nursing homes in this country. First, let me say, nursing homes require oversight.
Right.
Half the people have dementia. Mm-hmm. You don't want to put your granny or your parents in a nursing home that's abusive. So government oversight, I argue, is important for freedom at some level. But the way it works in this country is that most states have 1,000 or more rules that say things like food must be stored no less than 9 centimeters above a floor. There should be trash cans in every wastebasket.
Eggs must be cooked.
Eggs must be cooked. Yeah. There should be 0.09 recreational workers, per employee per some period of time. I mean, it's unbelievably, you call it micro regulation, and nursing homes in this country are horrible. Mm-hmm. People go through the day trying to comply. Inspectors come by periodically. They don't even try to evaluate whether it's a nice place or they're kind to the residents. What they evaluate is whether all the boxes have been
right, or if the food is only 6 centimeters off the floor, we got to shut it down,
or get a ticket.
In this final kind of instance of where it's not even clear who's running the show, you talk about I'm blanking now. It was a $50 million. Was it a reformatory or a prison or a former mental institution in New York State
So
that Andrew Cuomo wanted to shut down?
So when Andrew Cuomo got elected, New York State, like all states, has significant budget problems, in part because of the accretion of law and all the sort of pension benefits and things that have kind of piled up over the years. And he discovered that there was this juvenile detention facility upstate that cost $50 million a year to run. Mm-hmm. And there were no juveniles in it. It was empty and it had no prospects of being used. Right. So he said, well, this is easy. We're just going to shut this down. We're going to save $50 million right away. Right. Not so soon. It turns out that there's a law that requires that for any public facility with union employees, there has to be at least 1 year's notice before a facility can be shut down. So he wasn't allowed to shut it down. So the taxpayers had to pay another $50 million. I think that's 10,000 families paying each, $5,000 each extra in taxes that year to pay for a facility of no use whatsoever because of a law that's basically a kind of union feather bedding law.
Medicare's early days, you have, you know, we everybody recognizes now or seems to recognize that Medicare, the federal government's healthcare system for elderly people, the single payer system for elderly people is just, you know, one of the things that is beggaring the nation. You know, it's going to double in before 2040, it's going to double in the number of enrollees. It's going to cost us more, double the amount of money we're paying per person per year per enrollee. You talk about the early days of Medicare, about how doctors and providers game the system to squeeze, kind of maximize money. Talk a little bit about that, and then we'll talk about where this kind of mentality comes from and how to address it.
So Medicare was enacted in 1965. It actually, the bill was done over a weekend, the main bill, and they copied an Aetna plan. And basically, it introduced the idea of government providing a kind of fee-for-service reimbursement to people taking care of the elderly. And they had modeled a little bit the numbers of what it would cost based on existing cost of health care, and they had a certain numbers for it. And so the bill was enacted. A year later, the people who wrote the bill went out in the field to see how it was working. What they discovered is that all the cost modeling had been thrown out the window because doctors and hospitals had radically changed the way they practiced medicine. They were now practicing medicine to maximize reimbursement, not surprisingly. So they discovered things like gang visits to nursing homes, where doctors would go to a nursing home and, you know, a whole row of experts, and they would each see an elderly person and do an evaluation for a few minutes and then collect whatever the designated fee was for that. And we're getting rich, you know, off of this. And so they knew a year into it that this was going to turn into a budgetary nightmare. But in the culture of lawmaking in this country, nobody ever goes back and actually adapts or changes the law based on actual experience. And so now 40, 50 years later, it's on the verge of bankrupting the country.
And it's we just recently, or Congress is recently discussing the next, what's called the Doc Fix, which is when there was a statute back in the late 90s, I guess, that said we're going to reduce the per fee rate for services. Congress always manages to pass a temporary bump up so that day never comes. So
Right. And so you have the dynamics of Washington is that every special interest sees its role is simply preserving its benefits. So no one can ever claw anything back. And what needs to happen is to abandon the fee-for-service model.
Right.
And by the way, people know this. It's not a surprise. I mean, even the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, has provisions in it that says we need to move to what they call integrated care providers, where doctors and hospitals will do everything required for a patient for a fixed annual fee rather than piling it up.
You know, and we can already see, you know, how you would game that because we've had experience with HMOs in the past, which one of the ways that you do that is you get the money and then you give out less service.
That's right. So you have to have a better accountability mechanism. Right. But the one thing, two things that are needed. I mean, the healthcare is hard because there's a kind of an infinite demand for the services. So if there's not a market mechanism to deter use, and there's not an accountability mechanism to make sure that if it's a fixed fee, people are actually delivering the services, then there's a lot of room for
I mean, I guess this is implicit in what we're talking about, but you know, your book is focused on government because, you know, it's not that large corporations don't have bureaucratic nightmares and stupid rules that seemingly are issued by nobody but enforced by everyone or responsible to nobody. But it's the government. And how much of this is fundamentally a question of the public sector, because the public sector is not spending its own money, or it's not, you know, when you talk about what we need is a market, you know, if we had a market mechanism, why don't we have a market in healthcare, say?
Well, it is a government problem. Corporations do lots of stupid things, but sooner or later they fail.
Right.
And so it gets cleaned out. And you've seen that with lots of companies that just can't sustain their
old pattern.
A&T, Western Union,
IBM, or AT&T. Yes. They're either gone or a shadow of their former self, because they're beholden, they're shackled by their own lassitude.
And the nice thing about corporations, they may have stupid rules, but you put a new person in charge and they're in charge.
Mm-hmm.
They can change the rules.
Right.
You know, new boards, new shareholders, and you see lots of shareholder activism all the time, that's sort of pushing companies to do something that if they didn't have that sort of pressure or accountability, they would not.
And let's talk about this, because in the book, In the Rule of Nobody, you talk about how under current orthodoxy, the ideal government runs like a software program. Input the facts and outcomes of decision. You write, this technocratic model of the rule of law has many plausible virtues. Government can't act arbitrarily, if it's shackled by clear rules. Precision will offer predictability needed for citizens to plan their affairs. And it's unadulterated. This type of technocratic rule, the theory goes, is unadulterated by human judgment. But it comes at a cost. Talk a little bit about, where did the technocratic model come from? Why did it kind of gain dominance or hegemony in the way that things are done?
Well, it's an extremely good question, because having government that kind of works like a software program or automatic government appeals to everybody. It appeals to me. You know, who wants some official to have discretion to do something? You know, who knows what they might do?
And this includes, this is everything from a building permit, like you shouldn't have to, you know, kiss the ring of a building inspector, or to just get a permit, or a cop to get a gun permit, or, I mean, you could multiply this infinitely.
Sure, at every level.
Yeah.
You know, teachers, teacher authority, principal authority, and the worse government works, the more distrust there is.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody trusts the teacher anymore, or the principal anymore, or the cop anymore.
Right.
So we try to put in more rules to make sure they do the right thing. The problem is it doesn't work.
Right.
Its appeal is undeniable. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. It's not predictable. Rule of law is supposed to be predictable. There are too many rules.
Yeah.
It's just not predictable. They end up contradicting each other. Nobody knows what they are. And so instead of supporting freedom, now, increasingly, people assume they can't do things. They assume they don't have freedom, so there must be a rule somewhere. There have been studies that confirm that. Teachers and principals don't act. They don't maintain order because they assume they can't.
Right.
You know, that's
and you tell a story about a teacher who starts at a school, and they call up the maintenance person because the water fountain isn't working.
Right.
And they get chewed out for not following the proper way.
Water fountain repair. Procedures.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to go find the water fountain,
you
know, repair procedures? You know, it's like nothing is based on common sense. Nothing is based on the idea of what's the right thing to do. Right. Everything is, what does the rule require?
Well, you know, it seems in certain aspects of law or government, there is a pushback on this kind of technocratic rule. I mean, surprisingly to some, there's a number of kind of libertarian or conservative Republicans who are pushing back on mandatory minimum sentencing, which was enacted precisely to say, okay, we're removing the judge's latitude to make decisions here, because, you know, that's not right. The rule of law should be equal treatment for equal offenders.
Right.
At the same time, and this, I guess, is a story that's in the news, there's a DuPontaire named Roger Richards IV who he was found guilty of raping his children, but the judge said, well, you know what, we're not going to give him jail time because he wouldn't fare well in prison. And I'm not asking you to comment on that particular case, but that's one of the places where these dictatorial rules come from, right? Because you don't want, well, because he's a DuPontaire, he can buy justice.
Sure.
You know, we want equal laws applied to equally to all people.
So the ideal system of government, the ideal system of justice, is one that people reasonably trust. It's not one that guarantees the right result every time. it's one that people reasonably trust. And so if the ultimate purpose of law is to provide a framework for freedom so that people, when they go through the day, feel free to interact with others, both protected against abuse like fraud or theft mm-hmm. from others, and also reasonably confident that if they act reasonably,
right,
you know, they won't get in trouble.
Right.
And so we don't have that rule of law now. Government doesn't act that way, and people are increasingly insecure. America is now 20th in the world in ease of starting a business.
Right.
You know, because of all the...
You can curse. This is a libertarian area.
So it's really... So the system isn't working, but giving people the freedom to make judgments doesn't mean they will make the right judgments. But in criminal sentencing, because what happened was by trying to take away discretion, you actually ended up giving discretion to less trustworthy people, the prosecutors, mm-hmm. who would game the indictments to maximize the sentence under the rigid right. sentencing guidelines mm-hmm. so that they effectively could put a gun to the head even of an innocent mm-hmm. defendant.
Because they're looking, they're staring
they're looking
the
at a life sentence yeah. for some
right.
modest
right.
alleged crime
yeah.
because of the way the prosecutor organized mm-hmm. the indictment.
Right.
Well, who do we trust more? The prosecutor who's trying to make himself look good and has one interest, or a judge who at least is impartial?
Right.
And so, sure, judges will sometimes do the wrong things, and sometimes there's a way of dealing with that.
Well, you talk about, you know, finding the sweet spot between, you know, absolute discretion, which is tyranny of one form.
Yeah, unfettered discretion.
Yeah, or absolute rule, you know, right. being bound by rules, which is another form right. of tyranny. How do we know when we're at that place? You know, is there a particular time in history that we should look at, or how do we know that we're not fooling ourselves by giving government workers discretion?
Well, I think it's I actually see these as structural mm-hmm. points. I think law, talk about authority. Mm-hmm. No one should have unfettered authority to do whatever they want. And frankly, really no one does. I mean, you know, there's too many people around each decision. But the law for an official ought to have goals and principles. It's like a corral. And within that corral, the cop on the beat has the freedom to say, well, I'm not going to arrest that person for jaywalking because everyone in New York City jaywalks.
Right.
You know, then we would arrest everybody. Right. All of us would be in jail.
Right.
I'm going to keep my focus on crimes that people think are more important,
right.
even though jaywalking is illegal. And so within the corral, if you will, of an official's responsibility, the teacher ought to have responsibility, the authority in my view, to remove a disruptive student from the classroom immediately, mm-hmm. without any legal process, without having to prove its reasonableness. You know, you're not sending the person to jail, you're sending them out of the classroom.
But then there should be reviews so that if
sure.
they're only sending out students of a particular
right.
race or a particular ethnicity or gender
absolutely.
Or this or that.
And so yep. nobody should have unfettered discretion. Again, I said they're bounded
right.
by principles and goals. So then who decides, mm-hmm. you know, whether they're adhering to the principles and goals? Well, there has to be someone else with authority mm-hmm. to use their judgment, an independent person, about whether this person is acting fairly or not. In the school, it might be a parent-teacher committee. You might have independent people. For an inspector of a nursing home, mm-hmm. it's first a supervisor who could oversee it, but ultimately there's a court. If somebody's acting, trying to shut down a nursing home, you know, for the wrong reasons or because they didn't pay a bribe, mm-hmm. We have a court system that says, well, that would be illegal. It's clearly unreasonable. It clearly exceeds the authority of the person, you know, to demand a bribe or indeed to act arbitrarily. So nobody should ever have unfettered discretion. We ought to maintain all these sort of checks and balances. But the critical point is the checks and balances also depend on judgment.
Mm-hmm.
There's no kind of automatic put the piece of paper in and the right answer pops up.
Is that, is that a particular kind of disease or delusion of kind of post-war America? I mean, you know, of a kind of computer, you know, I'm thinking of like in the 1950s or 60s of like, Well, you know, you would see these geniuses with mainframe computers behind them with the wheels kind of, you know, and we have punch cards and, you know, it's scientific management. Yeah. And we're moving, or we're recognizing the limits of that model.
Completely. Yeah. It's really completely. It's interesting that, so I was talking with some senior people at Google about this. Software programs are built to be adaptable. They're actually the smart programs and the algorithms they build into them are all extremely adaptable. They allow people to approach problems from different ways. Mm-hmm. They allow them to adjust to different other programs and systems. We've built a legal system that's completely rigid, right, wrong, right? So it's binary in its ultimate sense. It's either legal or illegal. And so we weigh everybody down with increasing numbers of these chains.
Right.
And then wonder why nobody's getting anywhere. We can't rebuild a road or a bridge or maintain order in the classroom.
Let's talk a little bit about how we change the current system. In a chapter titled Restoring Human Control of Democracy, you write, America is overdue for a shift in values, away from automatic government and toward a structure that allows humans to make choices needed to adapt to local needs and global challenges. My vision is this: overthrow the bureaucracy and return to a system based on human responsibility. That's a great slogan. I could see it in a movie about the 60s or the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. Or, you know, it could be at the Berlin Wall. It could be at the beginning of Arab Spring. How do we create a shift in human values, a shift in values away from automatic government and towards human choice?
Well, ultimately, we have to convince the public that this vision of automatic government, which appeals to everybody, is dysfunctional, mm-hmm. that it's undermined their own freedom at the same time that it's made government dysfunctional.
And part of that is popular. Obviously, this is the long conversation you've been having in your public life of, you know, that there is a system of government in place which relies on this kind of technocratic model, and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. We wanted to eliminate human choice. So you combine this early industrial revolution notion of scientific management, where everybody's told how to do things.
Right.
You combine that, it didn't work the way they thought it was going to work.
But the idea is you don't want the third guy in a five-step assembly process suddenly freelancing and saying, oh, I'm going to start doing this.
Absolutely. So there's absolutely a role to organization.
Right.
And I get to that in a second. And then we come to the 1960s where we woke up to all these abuses. They were abuses, mm-hmm. racism, sexism, pollution, other things. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to create a system of government where no one would have the authority to make bad choices anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you marry that idea with scientific management and you get this model of incredible micro-regulation,
mm-hmm.
where all of a sudden rule books go from, a forest ranger used to have a little pamphlet with like 10 pages in it, what his guidelines were. They became thousands of pages.
Right.
And this coincided with our awakening that we needed more government oversight over things like pollution and other things. And so those rules started being written in a kind of micro-regulatory way, telling everyone exactly how to do everything.
Yeah, you liken it kind of to the Napoleonic Code, where, it, you know, instead of a general principle, it seems like at every point you want to imagine every possible permutation of every situation and have a rule.
Well, actually, we can talk about that.
Yeah.
The Napoleonic Code, looked at in hindsight, was a set of principles.
Right.
And was not, in most cases, you know, a set of detailed rules. They purported to be clear law, quote, clear law, but it relied on concepts like reasonableness and good faith, you know, just like, you know, generally law has to. And so we started this almost orgy of rule writing and lawmaking. And whenever possible, we made law unequivocal. So there could be no judgment. So when the special ed laws were passed, because there had been shameful abuse of disabled children, it was passed in 1975, it gave a right without any payment of each parent to an individualized education for their child. Well, as that evolved, that right evolved over the decades, now special ed consumes over 25% of the total K-12 budget in this country for the tiny proportion of children,
right,
well less than 10%, who really need it. It's been kind of overused. And there's nothing for gifted children, almost nothing for pre-K education. Well, who's decided that 25% of the budget is the right balance between all these different educational needs? And the answer to that is nobody has. It just took a life of its own. It's like a runaway train.
So apart from kind of publicizing this growth in automatic government and the deleterious effects, what's next? And what are, because you talk about structural reforms.
Right.
I mean, this is not something, you don't expect, you know, cancer to cure itself. Right. You don't expect a rotten government to fix itself. You know, the Berlin Wall wasn't pulled down with the help of the the GDR.
Right.
It was in spite
right.
of it. So
right.
what are the structural reforms that will you know, follow a change in values that
right,
need to be
right.
put in place?
Well, we need a new vision. And the structural reforms are a radical simplification of almost every area of government. It is beyond the capacity of a legislature to do this. It violates the laws of legislative physics for a body of hundreds of people
to
negotiate that.
This is not small ball. Like, you can't, we're not gonna fix tax policy or anything by saying, okay, let's tinker over here.
Right.
Is it, I mean, you talk about constitutional amendments. Right. I'm not fully sure if you're kind of being slightly ironic or not, but what you're calling for is a kind of, we need to
right.
clear the decks.
Right. History says that when societies need change, when the inertial forces drive a society to a point where it's close to paralysis or dysfunction, the change is never small ball.
Mm-hmm.
It's always big. Sometimes it's bad big.
Right.
The French Revolution was not great. The Arab Spring has ended up being a kind of nightmare
mm-hmm.
so far. The American Revolution was great.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those things are small ball.
Right.
The advantage of what are known as recodifications, which have happened periodically through
mm-hmm.
history, like with the Napoleonic Code,
mm-hmm.
like with the Uniform Commercial Code in the 1950s. We took this mess of commercial law in all the states and turned them into a uniform commercial code that everybody mm-hmm. so that everybody could contract with each other reasonably confident.
What set the table for that? I mean, are there specific moments? So for instance, at Reason, we talk a lot about the deregulation of interstate trucking and airline travel in the 70s, which was an interesting coming together of people on the left, Ralph Nader and Ted Kennedy, along with right-wing economists. What happened that the Universal Commercial Code was able to happen?
Well, you had business interests
mm-hmm.
saying having a discombobulated contract mm-hmm. law was standing in the way of progress.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had labor groups also saying this is standing in the way of jobs and progress.
Mm-hmm.
So you were able to get coalitions mm-hmm. of people, including leading contract law experts.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone saw that having a kind of jungle, kind of an Amazonian
yeah.
jungle for contract law made no sense. It needed to be clear and understandable.
Mm-hmm.
So they came together to fix it. What's needed today is a similar understanding that a much bigger Amazonian
right.
jungle of bureaucracy that we've built up over the last 50 years mainly has a similar effect.
Right.
It's paralyzing the society, and it's in everyone's interest except perhaps for isolated special interests.
Well, and or large their speaker or their agents in Congress say, I mean, you write, the odds are about zero that the Democratic Party will abandon, say, the perquisites of public employees unions. The odds are also low that the Republican Party will accept the need for a more flexible government. So, you talk, say, for instance, in the set of amendments that you suggest as a way of clearing the thicket, things like the president would actually be given more control over the executive branch, hiring and firing decisions, setting agendas. How will that happen?
It will only happen when there's public demand.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Washington works perfectly well on its own terms. It's inside a bubble. Mold has grown over it.
Right.
The mold are all these special interests and the money that goes back and forth. And there's a tug of war that keeps everybody employed and nothing much changes.
Right.
So why do they want to put their jobs at risk, whoever they are,
mm-hmm.
you know, by actually going to a better system. It's never going to happen until we actually put outside pressure to disrupt it.
That's you talk about that there's a, you know, this is the need for reform is actually a moral imperative for citizens, not for politicians.
Yeah, right, right. And so we, the citizenry, have gotten used to, and it probably get some pleasure out of the Schadenfreude, you know, out of how stupid government works.
Right.
Thank God we don't work for government.
Yeah.
You know, look at how bad they are. The problem is it's now affecting our lives. We can't start our business. Our kids can't even have a lemonade stand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the teacher can't maintain order in the classroom. It's affecting us everywhere. And our taxes are going up and our kids are going to go bankrupt because of the money we're spending on Medicare.
Do you, are you favorably disposed then towards groups like the Tea Party, which seem to be shaking things up? And you may not agree with their
right.
agenda, however that we define that. But, I mean, is that the type outside energy that needs to be directed?
Well, yes. That energy is very constructive. Mm-hmm. And, my quibble with the Tea Party is that they think the answer is to get rid of government altogether. Mm-hmm. And I agree and argue here that basically every government program is
right.
broken. But while there are some we certainly ought to get rid of, you know, all the subsidies from the New Deal and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that, you do want oversight over nursing homes. You do mm-hmm. want, you know, oversight over worker safety. But those programs are incredibly ineffective for the
right.
reasons I stated, and costly and inexpensive and get in the way of people doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the questions for a working government and society are, do people feel free to do what's right? Can mm-hmm. can government officials be practical? Can they balance a budget? Can they be fair? It doesn't guarantee they will be.
Is part of the problem, you know, you're obviously, we're in a nice neighborhood in New
right.
York where we're talking, you're doing extremely well and have, you know, things are hard for you. I mean, you might be in a position to start a business, but you can also, you can kind of create a walled garden and you can
right.
throw as much money as you need over the wall to evacuate
right.
government. You don't have to send your kids to the local school.
Right.
You don't have to send your parents to a public nursing home or anything like that. Is it that people are now able, more and more people are able to evacuate government and government services, and so the pressure that would build if we were all in this together is just not going to be there?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think that the people who have the resources to be more effective as advocates for change don't have the imperative for change. I mean, you know, one day a few months ago, a friend of mine came up to me, very successful businessman, saying, gosh, you know, that editorial you wrote in the Wall Street Journal was just great. It's just great that you're doing this. I said to him, well, great, well, you should get involved and help. He said, nah, it's hopeless, you know. And so that's to me, that's actually immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I argue in the book is that the solutions here, I actually don't think are that hard conceptually. It is not hard to come up with a model for environmental review where it takes a year or two, not a decade mm-hmm. or two. Germany does it that
right.
way, Canada does it that way. Really easy. You give the authority to decide when's enough's enough, and you make it happen. I could, with the possible exception of healthcare, because
mm-hmm.
again, this infinite demand and
right.
no market mechanism, every other program is actually really easy to fix. You simplify it, you make it go.
Well, and you talk, I mean, one of the truly obvious and simple rules that you suggest in your list of amendments is that any law with a budgetary impact would be sunsetted in 15 years. So it
yeah.
has to come up for review.
Yes, it has to come up because government, our founders actually made a mistake there. You know, there was this big debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, and the Anti-Federalists wanted to prevent the federal government from taking over state decisions. So they made it very hard to pass federal laws with all the checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
Fine, except 200 years later, now you've got all this sediment in the harbor, so nobody can get anywhere, all this law, and the same checks and balances apply to getting rid of a law as to passing
right.
in the first place, except that now the law has an army of special interests
mm-hmm.
around it. Every single law,
right.
like the special ed law, it's not money, it's these special
mm-hmm.
ed advocates who are zealots. They'll chain
mm-hmm.
themselves to your door. So no one can actually get rid of a law. It's so it's so unlikely, it's so difficult to actually amend a law in any significant way that nobody even thinks about it. Congress doesn't even know it's their job anymore. Well, who else's job it is? You know, all this law, who's in charge of whether it works or not? None of it works. Who's in charge? Nobody. Yeah. So we have a constitutional problem, and so I propose a sunset clause where every law with budgetary impact will sunset every 15 years, and to avoid Congress just giving lip service and reenacting it, which has been the experience in some states with sunset laws, make it constitutional and give an independent commission the job of actually just recommending what to do about it and having that be presented to the public before Congress can then act again. So it has a bogey against which it has to act, because otherwise...
But again, it is, I mean, on a certain level, I mean, there needs to be structural reforms, but in the end, it really depends on the will of the citizenry to say, you know what, enough is enough, or we share a vision of a limited government, you know, that is accountable. Talk a little bit in terms of, you know, how people help and whatnot. You're the president or chair of the Common Good Foundation. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's very important, as I argue in the book, that citizens get involved. And your point is that nothing's going to change, and if it does change, nothing's still going to work well unless citizens actually take ownership for these issues and feel like it's their job to help make democracy work. And now we've got a kind of absentee government where the citizens acquiesce in it and feel like it's out of their control, and it is largely out of their control.
I mean, it's fascinating, the budget, just the federal budget, about two-thirds of it is fully, is what's called mandatory spending, which is on autopilot, and then even a lot of discretionary spending is on autopilot.
It's public solvency is illegal. It's all been preset in legal concrete. You know, is it, I mean, basically doing anything sensible is illegal. Because it's all been, you know, preset in law. So citizens have to get involved both in making this happen and to making sure it will continue to happen. Our founders knew that. I mean, you know, Benjamin Franklin said, "What have you done?" He said, "Well, we've created a republic if you can keep it." And in what he was saying is that citizens have to be involved. So we actually need to create new institutions, citizen institutions that are not designed to take power, but to put pressure on those in power to make sure they actually are doing their jobs. And those institutions don't exist.
How does the Common Good fit into that vision?
Well, the Common Good is what we've been doing. We've been in business a dozen years. We create new visions for how law could actually work better. We had a joint venture with the Harvard School of Public Health to design a new system of justice for healthcare, basically to solve the medical malpractice problem where we waste, you know, $100 billion a year in defensive medicine, because doctors reasonably don't trust the system of justice because it's just jury by jury. So we would create a system of expert health courts. And then we built a coalition behind it. Everybody's for it. Romney's for it. Obama came out for it. All the debt commission. The trial lawyers have stopped it so far, but it will happen. Now we're redesigning the infrastructure approval process. And if we could get that passed, we have a couple of potential sponsors in the Senate, in the next year or two, we could hire 2 million Americans doing infrastructure over the next 4 or 5 years, just by changing, by simplifying the infrastructure approval process. So we're in the business of creating new visions. But what's needed now, and I argue in this book, is the big new vision. You know, not the new vision of just fixing this or that, but a new vision about how government could work. So what I'm, my ambition for this book is that other groups, allied groups, including people who run the Reason Foundation, will find common cause in the need for big change. And we'll come together in a kind of a coalition of the whole and say, we may not agree on what every solution is, but what we can all agree is this system of government is really out of control.
We'll end with, you know, take the facts and put them into your computer. What's the probability that big change will happen over the next 5 years?
I think the probability that big change will happen over the next 10 years is extremely high.
Is that 20%? Is it 80%? Is it?
Yeah, it's 75%.
Okay.
And the reason big change will happen is not because of what I do or you do or anybody else does. The reason it'll happen is because we'll have a crisis, and the current system is truly unsustainable. But what's important when you have a crisis, because you don't want to end up like the French Revolution.
Right.
You don't want Occupy Wall Street to be in charge. It's very important to have a new vision. And if you have a new vision, then maybe you'll get leaders. I'm talking to former Governor Mitch Daniels about creating a new center at Purdue where we would actually begin building a vision block by block and go through government programs and analyze how they don't work and come up with models of how they might work and begin to...
Well, and so this is the, I believe it was Milton Friedman who said that, you know, the goal of people who trade in ideas and public policy is to make things that seem politically inevitable become, or rather politically impossible, become politically inevitable, because when the crisis comes, people will be looking around for, okay, will this work? Will this work?
Right. And so what I'm arguing for ultimately here is a structure of government of the sort that our founders contemplated, where leaders are elected, they take responsibility, they actually act on their values, they don't try to avoid their values, they act on their values, because that's what we elected them for, and they succeed or fail, and they're held accountable. And the model, all of life works on responsibility. Everybody listening to this program has achieved what they've achieved in life because they took responsibility to make it happen. Government's no different than that. Somebody's got to take responsibility. They'll fall down, they can be held accountable, they'll pick themselves up, or somebody else will take their place. And if you can't be practical, you can't be fair, you can't be moral, and you can't balance a budget. And that's where we are right now in this state, which means we're going to have to rebuild it.
Well, we will leave it there. The book, the new book by Philip K. Howard, is The Rule of Nobody, Saving America from Dead Laws and Broken Government. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Nick.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.